You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like...
Whoa.
And... Not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.
Can your savings weather an economic storm? There are very few physical assets you can invest in that are proven to stand the test of time. Gold has withstood as a valued form of money for millennia, and Birch Gold lets you convert a retirement account into a tax-sheltered IRA and physical gold that doesn't cost you a penny out of pocket. Text COAST to 989898 and claim your free info kit on gold. Text COAST to 989898 and secure your savings today.
Spectrum Internet has enough speed to handle all your needs, so you can work, game, and stream with speeds up to a gig. Plus, Spectrum's advanced Wi-Fi provides enhanced security for all your connected devices. Get Spectrum Internet with fast and reliable speeds, starting at just $29.99 a month with a 2-year price guarantee. Visit spectrum.com/internet for you for full details. Offer subject to change, valid for qualified residential customers only. Restrictions apply.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Now here's a highlight from Coast to Coast AM on iHeartRadio.
Mark Hartsman, apologies again for asking you that question about Charles Davis and not giving you enough time to respond. Can you pick up the story there about what happened to him?
Yeah, of course. So as I was saying, it's been fully investigated by the FBI. This was, you know, documented in newspapers, and there was really no clear explanation that ever came through for what happened to him. And after that, you know, he put it out of his mind. Like I said, James McDonald had interviewed him and his mother and grandmother several years later. And that was pretty much all he thought about. He didn't use this to try to like capitalize on this, you know, on an experience or anything like that. It was just something weird that happened to him, is all he said. He didn't know what it was, just something odd. But what makes this story even stranger, and this was something that Dave had shared with me, David Marler had shared with me when he first told me about Charles Davis. He started looking into the case and finding that other top-shaped UFO sightings were happening in the weeks before and after this in different parts of the country, mostly like Georgia and North Carolina. And there were these other documented reports of people seeing top-shaped objects flying overhead and in several cases also belching fire and injuring different people in the process. Even stranger, this was happening on Tuesday night. So frequently that people were having watch parties on Tuesday nights with top-shaped objects. And again, none of these were ever explained. There were no, you know, government didn't say, oh yeah, we're testing some new aircraft or whatever it was. None of that ever came out. And so I love this story to introduce the book because it is one of these truly odd, weird things that happened. It's unexplained. And that's the case with so many stories. I mean, you had mentioned earlier the idea of these, you know, aircraft or unidentified craft flying overhead, you know, no sound, just sitting overhead in people's, you know, whether it's in people's yards or over highways or whatever it might be. And I have cases like that I talked about in the book that truly are just unexplained. And that's part of what keeps this whole topic so mysterious and interesting.
And what does Charles Davis think now?
So when I talked to him, I mean, he basically still maintains that he doesn't know what it is. He said, all I know is something where it happened to me. I'm not telling you it's aliens or UFO, but I don't know. It has no explanation for it and doesn't try to create one for it.
I mean, tops, UFOs that look like tops that are belching fire, you don't hear about many of those anymore. I think I remember from one of the cases that you document in this book, it was also stinky, right? It was really smelled bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So that's too. And this, you know, adding to the idea that you just said, like, you don't see those too often that shape, especially at that time, everything was more saucer shaped, you know, or at least cigar shaped, right? You didn't hear top shape. So why would someone just suddenly make that up if they kind of wanted to capitalize on the situation? So it's definitely an unusual series of cases.
What do you make of that? That there are so many, you look at the history of this phenomenon, there are so many hundreds of shapes and sizes of these objects. Some are the same as what we see today. There's spheres and occasionally discs, but cigar shapes, triangles, many are pretty weird shapes. As like we get the variety pack here. Are they, you know, alien Chevys, Chryslers, and Fords, different sport models, station wagons? What's going on?
That's a good way to put it. Even rectangular shape, you know, hear a lot of like, you know, football field size objects being seen. And I mean, that's a good question. You know, first of all, when we think about the idea of extraterrestrial visitors, who's to say it's just, you know, one species from one particular place that might be visiting. So in that sense, yeah, maybe it is different beings, different vehicles that they're creating. So it's a good question. I personally find the triangular UFOs really fascinating.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, the Phoenix Lights probably be the most famous of them, which was seen by about 20,000 people, you know, silently passing over Phoenix and the surrounding area throughout the state. Just in 1997, fairly recent, right? So, and that's another one that's just never really been explained. Even the governor admitted that he saw that and had no explanation for it.
I liked that you covered, you mentioned James McDonald, Dr. James McDonald. It's not a name that people hear all that often in UFO circles anymore, but gosh, what a gigantic figure he was back then. And he was a courageous guy. I mean, he put it all on the line and ultimately paid the price for going down into the UFO rabbit hole. Can you share with our audience who he was and what he did?
Yeah, so he was a physicist who really took on the subject at a time when there weren't that many scientists really getting involved in it. I mean, you had J. Allen Hynek as an advisor to Project Blue Book, but, you know, early on he was working really more to debunk it along with the sort of the goals of Project Blue Book. Eventually kind of came around. But James McDonald really took it seriously and investigated it, again, with a scientific mind. And he was involved in the congressional hearings in the late 60s and, you know, presented many cases and documented, you know, facts and shared data. But you're right, he didn't get a great response. You know, he wasn't joined by other scientists. It wasn't like it is today where you have people coming together looking at things and trying to find answers. He was kind of on his own. So you're right, he was very courageous. And, you know, ultimately, it didn't bode well for his career or his life.
Father's Day is coming, a day we celebrate the guy who's always there for us. To crack a dad joke. Well, you know what's not a dad joke? Getting $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker with the purchase of his favorite cocktail capsule pack. $50 off. No dad joke. See, this is a dad joke. I lost my glasses today, and guess who I bumped into? Everyone. But the Bartesian Cocktail Maker, it's no joke. Each cocktail capsule contains real fruit juices and all natural bitters, so dad can make over 60 premium cocktails he loves. Sidecars, old fashions, gimlets, all with the push of a button. So, for the dad who loves a cocktail with friends and a good joke from time to time, get the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. $50 off now until Father's Day. Visit bartesian.com/father to get 50 off the best premium cocktail maker for dad at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
He took his own life, right? He ended his life.
That's right.
He was under a lot of pressure. I remember a lot of criticism, as happens still for scientists and others who go out on a limb on this. You cover a lot of the really fascinating cases from back in previous eras. Kelly Hopkinsville, I think it's a great example. We've talked about it on this show before. This is a preposterous scenario is almost preposterous by design, where aliens are passing around this home and they keep getting shot, almost like a shooting gallery. They get shot by the people in this family, and they keep bouncing back up. What do you make of that whole scenario?
Yeah, it really is a fascinating case, and I have a couple images in the book of sketches and details of what these creatures look like. And one of the headlines from 1955 that said, "Story of Spaceship 12 Little Men Probed Today," at this Kelly farmhouse. And yeah, and basically these guys, family and a couple of friends saw these creatures. They seem to be like monkey shaped, monkey sized, with outfits on, and shooting at them. Like you said, they're climbing up trees on roofs, and it just kept coming back. And there was, of course, no bodies. If they shot them and hit them, there was no evidence left behind. The police came out and investigated, talked about how terrified these guys were. They said they were genuinely terrified. They didn't seem like they were making anything up. But they couldn't find any evidence. Here's the story, but okay, we don't see any evidence of this. And there was really no great explanation for this. There was at one point they thought that maybe these were monkeys who had escaped from a circus that was traveling nearby, which is kind of an interesting hypothesis that monkeys had gotten that far and somehow had avoided bullets, evaded them from multiple guns at that time. So yeah, it's definitely one of those interesting early cases, and it's kind of one of those ones I think that helped push the little green men narrative in that description.
Right.
Interesting.
I know you spent some time with David Marler, so I'm surprised that I looked in the index and did not find Farmington, New Mexico. I don't know if you ran across much information on that, but what a spectacular incident that was, where these UFOs sort of had a dogfight. I mean, dozens, maybe hundreds of these objects over this town in New Mexico that were seen in the daylight by all kinds of people. I mean, basically everybody who lived there. Did you dig into that and pass on it, or did Marler not share you his secret files on that one?
he took me through so many files. And to be honest, there was so much to go through that at some point I kind of did pick and choose a little bit. I can't tell you I had a particular reason for not including that case.
Right.
I think I was just finding cases and using as much as I could. I actually had about 20,000 words too much when I delivered the book.
I understand that.
Yeah. Fortunately, I couldn't cover as many cases as I would have liked, but yeah, that's definitely another interesting one.
It's probably hard to convince the publisher that a 900 page book is going to sell all that well.
I think I kept at least another 8,000 to 10,000 of those words that I initially was asked to trim. So,
oh, good deal.
I made some progress.
It's hard to cover the legitimacy of the truly old cases. You cover the modern UFO era back to the late 40s and 50s. But similar objects have been reported throughout human history. The Romans called them flying shields. There are things in the Bible, Ezekiel's wheel, that other people compare to modern UFOs. The idea that these things have been around a long time, that if they're visitors, they've been watching us for a long time, or maybe they live here. You tend to come across as sort of agnostic. You don't put your feet down in either camp in a definitive way, but What do you think about the idea of the visitors not being visitors at all?
Yeah, well, actually, I had a whole chapter on sort of that ancient alien idea, and that kind of got cut for that word count length I mentioned. But I took, if you saw in the book, I took some of those sections and put them around the book as sidebars because I didn't want to lose that whole aspect of the story because it is a really interesting part of the whole UFO phenomena just throughout humanity. And some of it I find really quite interesting. I mean, to me, Ezekiel's vision, that was something that I read about in high school and wrote a paper about in my AP English class.
Huh.
I was so fascinated by it. My teacher didn't really agree with it, which was interesting. but yeah, I thought that, you know, here's this amazing description of this chariot coming down from the heavens with these strange creatures with these amazing descriptions of faces that, you know, resemble different animals, multiple animals on these, you know, on these creatures. And of course, there's someone sitting in a throne in the center of it, right? So what could this thing be? And so I talked about that, you know, is it an early UFO sign just using the terminology that Ezekiel may have had at the time, or is there a different context just in terms of, you know, what he may have been experiencing back then? So it's an interesting case, and yeah, it's hard to have anything definitive about that, right? This is all just about theory. But I did talk about some of the other cases, you know, whether things like Stonehenge or the pyramids may have been built by aliens. And there's a lot of evidence that shows how, you know, how some of that could have maybe been done. For example, part of the Nile back then has been revealed recently to have actually had another pathway that actually went by the pyramids. So floating stones and so forth may have been a bit more possible than previously suspected. But I also think we shouldn't underestimate the ingenuity of humanity to build some of these structures. That said, there's some of them that are truly extraordinary that really do leave you wondering how people were capable of some of these things.
Yeah.
So who knows? I personally think that if UFOs had come back then and helped build some of these things, they could have used more than just the natural resources and left something behind as well. I mean, I look at like what we're doing on Mars right now as an example. So we have rovers there now, right? But before we put humans there, we'll send other machinery there that will 3D build habitats for us, and we'll bring some of our technology from here to there. So I do wonder, like, if they were here that long ago, when they've been advanced enough to have done something similar. So that kind of goes through my mind a little bit in some of those cases. But in other cases, there's UFOs and artwork that goes back to, like, the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
And people look at these paintings, they say, well, what is that? That's a UFO. On the other hand, if you ask an art historian, they'll say, well, that's how they represented the sun and the moon at that time. You know, they had, like, a figure driving, you know, a vehicle that was representing the moon, sort of a, you know, crescent-type shape. Object. So again, some of it depends on the perspective and the lens you're looking at through.
Yeah, interpretation. I'm in my own research, I am impressed by some of these cases from the 50s or even 60s where these craft are described by in military documents and other and news accounts where they fly circles around our best planes. They do amazing things. You know, today, if that happened, we'd blame it on Chinese drones. Or something we just haven't discovered yet. Russians, Chinese, Israelis, Iranians, whatever. I find them to be pretty persuasive and give a lot of credence to the idea that these are from someone else, that someone else built them, given that they were far in advance of what our planes could do at the time. I don't know how you feel.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think that's a really interesting way to look at, because we can look at the things, the UAP that we're seeing now, and you know, you could say, okay, is there a foreign adversary that's far advanced? Or, you know, do we have technology that's that far advanced that's completely secret right now? You know, possibly. But when you look back, like you said, the 50s, and you see the same kinds of descriptions, it's hard to imagine that anyone could have been that far advanced back then, right? Like we talked about earlier, like the U2, that was far advanced in the 50s. But something like, you know, the Tic Tac UAP, we weren't that far along. No one was that far along back in the 50s. So you do wonder, okay, well, maybe you can explain some of that away today, but how do you explain it away from 70 years ago?
Right. Lee Spiegel was a friend of yours?
Yes.
You cover in his role in the United Nations. There were attempts to get the United Nations into the UFO mystery in a big way. I have on my wall here, I have a collection of postage stamps from Grenada. The Prime Minister of Grenada was actively involved in trying to get the UN involved, and he ultimately failed, but he went and issued these postage stamps anyway. They're beautiful. And our friend, the late Lee Spiegel, was directly involved in all that United Nations stuff. Can you share with us a little bit about how that went?
Yeah, so Lee Spiegel, he started investigating the UFO phenomenon in the 1970s. And he had his own sighting, which we can talk about as well. But he worked with the president of Grenada. Grenada had heard about Lee Spiegel, and he'd been trying to get something with the UN going. And so Lee kind of stepped in, helped him out, and just helped organize the whole thing, and was able to get a lot of interesting people to join him at the UN to have basically the first time the United Nations ever talked about UFOs to address this in front of, you know, in front of the world. So he had along with him Jacques Vallée, Gordon Cooper, the astronaut, Stanton Friedman, and another Army Reserve Captain Lawrence Coyne, who had his own encounter in a helicopter. So he had this amazing group assembled, and they were able to address the UFO phenomena in front of the United Nations, and they were going to create basically a system where international groups could share information and try to learn together what was going on and just kind of facilitate the whole process. And so this was all going along actually quite nicely until the president of Grenada was ousted, and that kind of made the whole thing fall through. This was 1978, by the way, just for a little bit more context.
Right, right.
But yeah, it was the first time they'd ever assembled it with the General Assembly of the United Nations for the topic of UFOs.
Listen to more Coast to Coast AM every weeknight at 1 a.m. Eastern, and go to coasttocoastam.com for more.